seated.
So this morning we are so blessed to have Dr. Jason Lyle from ICR, Institute for Creation Research. He was with us last year, and so this year he's out. He's going to be doing a conference Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Oceanside. So we figured since he's out here, we'll use him and abuse him. So we get to have him here Sunday morning. So let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Lyle.
Well, it's good to be back with you this week, and I want to talk about how science confirms biblical creation. This is not one I normally do on a Sunday morning, but your pastor requested it, so if it doesn't go well, it's his fault. All right. You know, people think, well, why, you know, talk about science in church? Well, you know, the Bible talks about things that are scientific. It does. I mean, think of the worldwide flood. You've got biology going on inside the ark. You've got hydrology going on outside the ark. You've got meteorology going on above the ark, astronomy above that. The Bible does address issues that are matters of science. And yet the Bible has been attacked on the basis, allegedly, of science. That's the place where people say, well, you know, you can't trust the Bible anymore. And by the way, it's almost all those attacks are directed at Genesis. That's the place where people say, well, you can't trust the Bible. There's no way that God created in 6 days. We know that millions of years of evolution, that's the way life came about. Isn't that true? Isn't that what you hear people say? That's the place where the doubt begins. And then we wonder why we have all these problems in our society. Well, people no longer believe that the Bible is the Word of God. They don't think that this really is true history. And if the history in the Bible is not true, why would we trust its moral teachings? Why would we trust that we need Jesus to be saved? If God didn't tell the truth in the beginning, why should we trust that He got the rest of it right? The secularists have done something very clever. What they've done is they've taken their belief system of naturalism, the belief that all things are natural, all things are within and governed by natural laws. Of course, many things are, but not all things. But they've taken that belief system, and they've tried to swap it out and say, well, that's science. To be scientific is to be a naturalist. And therefore, you can't be a Christian, right? Because the Christian worldview is supernatural. We believe in a God who is beyond nature and who controls it supernaturally. It's a very clever strategy, because we should have some respect for science, and most people do. Allows us to put people on the moon, allows us to make PowerPoint presentations, allows, you know, cars and all this technology that science has made possible. And then what they've tried to do is they say, you have confidence in that, right? You have confidence in science. Well, evolution is science, and so you should believe evolution. That's a clever strategy. But it's misguided, because science, when you understand it, confirms what the Bible teaches. It does not confirm evolution. And that's what I want to cover this morning. You've probably run into somebody who's had an objection to Scripture, and they've said, well, we, you know, what about this alleged fossil that's found? See, that disproves the Bible, and so on and so forth. And many Christians don't know how to address that. But we all need to be ready to give an answer when anyone asks us for that reason of the hope that's in us, and with gentleness and respect. We need to be prepared to give an answer. And God calls a few people, like myself, to go out and get a PhD and really tackle some of the nuanced issues of science. But you know what? You don't have to be a PhD to know just the basics of science and how the basics of science confirm biblical creation. That's what I want to share with you today. Sound pretty exciting? You can use this information then and share this with people. And I find that it opens people's eyes and they realize, wow, maybe I need to take this Bible seriously. I'm not going to give you a proof of creation this morning. I do have other presentations I do on that. I just want to show you that when you have a basic understanding of science, it lines up with what God has said in His Word. There are a lot of brilliant people in the world, and a lot of them believe in creation, a lot of them believe in evolution. But we have the same world. The reason that creationists and evolutionists can look at the very same evidence, the same fossils and so on, and come away with very different conclusions about how that fossil came about is because we have a different understanding of how the world works, a different worldview, which you can think of like a lens through which you view the world. And the Bible gives us the correct view of history. It's corrective lenses. It allows us to see the world as it is. My secular colleagues tend to believe in naturalism, man's idea about how the world began and how it came to be the way it is today. Those who believe in these naturalistic versions think that, well, they've already got in their mind millions of years of evolution, slow, gradual processes producing the Earth. Earth's billions of years old, allegedly. And so they're looking at the world that way, and it's not surprising that they draw conclusions that are consistent with that worldview. But I look at the world through the recorded history of Scripture, And that's what the Bible is primarily. It's a history book. It's got other types of literature in it, poetic sections like the Psalms and so on. But it's primarily a history book. It tells us what happened. It goes through and gives us the major of events that have happened in history and even tells us what's going to happen in the future. At least it gives us some little tidbits on that. Now, when I look at the world, I look at it through biblical history, and that's going to give me the correct understanding of the evidence. And what I want to show you today is that when we cover just the basics of science, stuff that every Christian should know, when you understand that, you can be able to give a defense to anyone who asks you of a reason for the hope that's in you. You can do that. Anybody can do it. And I want to cover just three fields of science today. I'm going to cover genetics, which is the study of how traits are passed on from one organism to the next. Information theory, which a lot of people haven't even heard of, but it's very powerful confirmation of biblical creation. And then we'll touch on geology as well, things like rocks and fossils. And do those confirm biblical creation, or do they confirm millions of years of evolution? We'll see they confirm creation. And in all these fields, by the way, you might say, Dr. Lau, you're a scientist, and you know, it's expected for you to know this kind of information. But my PhD is in astrophysics, and so when it comes to these fields, I'm on the same level as the rest of you. I really am, because these are just the basics that we're going to cover today. And yet, from just those basics, we can see that the Bible really is true. It's real history. Let's start with genetics, which is the study of heredity, how traits are passed on from one organism to the next in human beings and animals and plants. And we're going to use dogs a lot in the examples today, because we can see how dogs. It'll make sense when we come to it. So my first question for you is, do animals change like dogs? Do dogs change? Do dogs change? Do they? Yeah, they change. Yeah. What do they change into? Dogs. Yeah. Dogs changing into dogs. Yeah. And that's what we'd expect in the creation worldview, because the Bible says that God created animals according to their kinds, or after their kinds. That phrase is repeated 10 times in Genesis. We better take it seriously. Yes, God created organisms, plants as well. Plants reproduce after their kind. Animals reproduce after their kind, and human beings beget human beings. That's what we'd expect on the basis of what Scripture teaches. By the way, a kind is not the same as a species. God didn't say that he created animals according to their species. That's a modern word, okay? The biblical word kind, or created kind, bara men in the Hebrew. And that's what we would call a reproductively isolated unit that's always been isolated. Let me give you an example. A group of mosquitoes, they go off and they live in a cave for 100 years, and they reproduce in that cave and so on. And when they're brought back out, they're no longer able to interbreed with the parent population due to genetic drift. Their DNA has changed a little bit. And so they're now classified as a different species. Now, that can happen. My point is, they're still mosquitoes. What were they in the past? Mosquitoes. What will they be in the future? Mosquitoes. That's not evolution, it's just mosquitoes. It's the same way with dogs, right? You can get lots of different variation within the dog kind, but they always remain dogs. You'll never get anything else. You can get lots of different variation within the dog kind, but you're always going to get dogs. You can have dogs with short fur, we can do that for you. You want dogs with long fur, we can do that for you. You want a dog with feathers, you're out of luck. Okay? And we'll see why that is when we go through this. That's what we'd expect in the creation worldview. Now, the reason I want to point this out is because evolutionists often misrepresent what it is that creationists teach. Sometimes evolutionists will say, well, creationists believe that God created all the organisms as we see them today. I don't know of any creationist that believes that. It's certainly not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches God created kinds. Some kinds have gone extinct, but they've diversified since creation. This is a misrepresentation of what it is that creationists teach. I don't believe, for example, that God created poodles in the Garden of Eden, right? Because it was a paradise. So you're not going to have poodles running around biting your leg and so on. You with me? Yeah. That wouldn't make any sense. No, the Bible tells us things have changed, and one of those changes was the curse and the fall, and that's how you end up with things like poodles. Anyway, this is a misrepresentation of reality. What we believe, in fact, is that God created kinds. And those kinds have diversified. Sometimes they've diversified into multiple species, but they're the same kind. They always have been. They always will be. And so we believe in variation within kinds. Some people call that evolution, but, well, fine. We all believe in that type of evolution. Evolution can just mean change. But the controversy is, what kinds of change? That's where the issue comes about, right? It's an equivocation fallacy when evolutionists change the meaning of a word in the middle of an argument, right? Well, you believe in change, evolution has changed, so you believe in evolution. Well, that's misleading, isn't it? I could equally well say, you believe that cars are created, right? So you believe in creation. You see, it's the question of what kind of evolution is possible. Evolutionists who hold to the Darwinian or neo-Darwinian view of evolution believe that something like a bacteria, a single-celled organism, diversified over millions of years into all the different forms of life that we see on Earth today. And so in their view, there really aren't distinct kinds. Everything's related to everything else. You are related to broccoli in the evolutionary worldview. That's your distant cousin. And I find that very disturbing on a number of levels. Anyway, by the way, I was speaking to a group of atheists one time, and I mentioned that. I said, you know, in your worldview, you're related to broccoli. And afterwards, one of them came up and said, weren't you kind of poking fun at us for, you know, you said related to broccoli? And I said, well, isn't that what you believe? He said, well, yeah. I said, well, there you go then, right? I mean, I'm just reflecting back to you what you claim to believe. If it sounds strange, maybe you ought to reconsider your belief. Don't shoot the messenger, right? Anyway, in the evolutionary view, that change is upward and unlimited. You can get very complex organisms from simpler organisms like bacteria, which is not a simple organism, but it's simpler than you are, for example. Now, to understand which of these two views is confirmed by science, we need to know something about DNA. This is a very long molecule that occurs in all the cells of your body. Well, not all the cells, but the reproducing cells of your body. And it looks something like a twisted ladder like that. It's got these, on the rungs of these ladder are these nucleotide base pairs. There's four different varieties, and they're always represented by those four letters, C, G, A, and T. And depending on how these are arranged, it actually codes for instructions to make the proteins that make up you. It's really phenomenal. Much as you could spell help with beads on a rope in Morse code, you can actually spell out, you could write a book in DNA, theoretically. It's just, it uses a different alphabet. It's a four-letter alphabet instead of a 26-letter alphabet. But you could do it. You could write a book in DNA, and that would be a very efficient way of writing a book because it's a very small, it's a molecule, right? To me, that's amazing. I mean, we think we can get all this information on a Blu-ray, and that is impressive. God put all the information to make you on a molecule. That's amazing. It is to me, anyway. And the reason you are a person and not a cabbage is because you have instructions to make a person, and a cabbage has instructions to make a cabbage. And I think you got the better deal on that one. But in any case, and by the way, some of our DNA is the same. We actually share some DNA with a cabbage. Now, why is that? Evolutionists say, well, because we're descended from a common ancestor, of course. And I would say, no, wait a minute. First of all, we have a common creator, so I'd expect some similarities. But secondly, DNA codes for proteins. It's what results in the proteins that you have in your body. And we can use, see, when you eat something, you're taking in proteins that your body can use. So you see, if cabbage had a totally different set of DNA and didn't have the same proteins as we have, we couldn't eat it. We wouldn't benefit from its nutrients. And so if God had created all organisms with totally different DNA and totally different proteins, the only thing we'd be able to eat is each other. That would not be good. So you see, God does know what he's doing. Now you have two sets of DNA. You get one set from dad, you get one set from mom. They have two sets of DNA, and they got it from their parents and so on, all the way back to Adam and Eve. And the thing that's really neat is in the process of reproduction, you get one of the two sets, and it forms a new set. It's sort of like you see here, and you don't know which one you're going to get in advance. It's apparently random. I'm sure that God has a plan and a reason for doing that, but we can't predict it on a human level. And so you can actually have traits that your parents have, right? You might have, you know, the same color eyes as your parents. Well, that's because you got the information from them. But you can also have traits that neither parent has because you have a unique combination. And so just from two people, it's ingenious, right? I mean, by using, instead of a single strand of DNA, God uses two, and it's the combination. And there are many different combinations that are possible. In fact, from just two people, they could produce more unique children than there are atoms in the universe. It's amazing. That's an ingenious way of encoding that information. And so it's no problem to get all of our traits. And if you think about it, all the information to make all the traits in us was in Adam and Eve. That's pretty neat. And we know now that mathematically there's room for many more people. It's not a problem. Here it is with blood type. You know about the different blood types. Maybe you remember doing this in school where you have the dominant gene and then the recessive. A is dominant, O is recessive. And so if you have both of them, the A dominates and your blood type is A. A and B are co-dominant, so your blood type is AB. The only way you can have blood type O is to have both O alleles, both O genes. and that's how that works. And if, for example, mom had blood type A, and it's the heterozygous combination with the O and the A, and dad had blood type B, the children could have any possible blood type. Isn't that interesting? And so they could you could get the A from mom and the O from dad, your blood type's A. You get the only way you can get the O blood type is to get the O from mom and the O from dad. You see how that works there? My point here is that all of the information to make you was in your parents. Okay? But it wasn't necessarily expressed the same way because your combination might be different. And it's kind of like I got brown eyes. My mom has brown eyes. I got that from her. My brother has kind of green eyes. He got that from my dad. He's got green eyes. My sister has blue eyes. I used to tell her she was adopted. She didn't believe me. But well, that's because the blue is a recessive trait. And so that information was still in mom and dad. It just wasn't expressed, you see. And so all of the information that's in you was in your parents. They got it from their parents. They got it from their parents all the way back to Adam and Eve. Here it is with skin color. Now, we all basically have the same skin color, brown. It's just a question of how much. There's a pigment called melanin. There's a couple different forms of it. But the one that determines the shade, it's kind of a gray in color. And if you have a lot of it, you tend to be very dark-complected. If you have a little bit of it, it's very light-complected. Again, this is simplified, but the basic principles here are true. Now, if you're in this box and you get married to somebody in that box, your kids are going to be in that box too, because only the lowercase letters are available, you see. And likewise, if you're here and you get married to somebody there, or here even, you have only lowercase A's and uppercase B's, and you get married to somebody in that box, your kids will be in that box. But if you're off-axis, if you're along here, let's say you're in this box, you've got all combinations available if you get married to somebody in that box. And by the way, we think Adam and Eve probably had a middle brown color, and they were probably one of these combinations, you see, because then their children could have had skin color ranging from very dark to very light. Must have been kind of exciting for them. I wonder what shade this one will be. I wonder what shade that one will be. But obviously they wouldn't both be here or both there. There's other ways God could have done it, but that's one way. We're going to again focus on dogs because we see lots of variety in dogs. My point is, all that variety, you only need two dogs. You can pack that into two dogs. It just wasn't expressed because it's the combinations that determine what the traits will be like. So you don't need two of every breed of dog on the ark. You just need two dogs on Noah's ark. That's all he needed. And you can get all those breeds later. And the dogs on Noah's ark would have had the heterozygous combination, big A, little A, big B, little B, big C, little C. And then their descendants, as depending on how it works out, can have various combinations, and you have all these different variety in dogs. Now, so far, this is all what we would expect given biblical creation, right? We see organisms reproducing according to their kinds, and they're not changing into any other sort of organism, any other kind. Now, in the evolutionary view, you've got something like bacteria, single-celled organisms, and they've got some information in their DNA. And the idea is, over billions of years, they became something like a horse, for example. Now, if that's true, if evolution's true, then these bacteria at some point gained new instructions, new information in their DNA. Isn't that right? Wouldn't that have to be the case if that were true? Because bacteria have some instructions in their DNA, but a horse has a lot more. It's not just that it has more DNA, which it does, but it's got more instructions in its DNA. It's got more information. A horse has the information in its DNA to produce eyes. A horse has the information in its DNA to produce bones. Bacteria do not have those instructions, and they can't produce those traits. So if evolution is true, then information has to what? It has to increase. Isn't that right? I mean, isn't that just logically it has to be that way? Because those organisms, these kind, have more information than these kinds. So if these kind turn into that kind, you got to add information. There's no way around it. Evolution requires an increase in information in DNA. And I'm saying that several different ways because it's crucial that you get that point. It's very important. Because you see, the processes that we observe in nature scientifically decrease information in DNA, or are neutral perhaps, but they don't increase it. And what that means is we don't see scientifically evidence for evolution. We don't. Let me give you an example of this. One example is natural selection. A lot of people think that natural selection is evolution. It's not. And we're going to see they're actually opposites. Natural selection is a true principle of nature, and it's the opposite of evolution. Let me show you this. Here's how it works, and again, with dogs. So you got two dogs, okay, and let's suppose they have a gene for short fur and a gene for long fur. And those, let's suppose those genes have a combined effect, which many genes do. They're codominant. And so these dogs have medium length fur. Okay, no problem there. We can understand that. Again, this is simplified, but the genetic principles here are true. And so let's say they produce some offspring. Now, some of the pups are going to get the short gene from mom, and they're going to get the short gene from dad, right? And they're going to have short fur. They got the information from their parents. Even though their trait's different, their parents have medium length, they have short length fur, but they still got the instructions from their parents. Just they have a unique combination. Some pups will get the short gene from mom and the long gene from dad, or the short gene from dad and the long gene from mom. 50% of the offspring would end up with medium length fur, just like their parents. And some of the pups would end up with a long gene from mom and a long gene from dad, and they end up with very long fur. Okay, no problem. This is a great example of variation within a kind. Any evolution here? Well, not in the molecules demand sense, right? Because we haven't gained any new information. We started with information for short and long and by combination medium, and we ended up with information for short and long and by combination medium. No new information's been added. It's just variation within a kind. We started with dogs, we ended up with dogs. It's just dogs. It's not evolution. Well, okay, natural selection kicks in, though. Let's suppose that the environment gets very cold. Now, the dogs that have the shorter and medium-length fur, they don't do so well in that cold environment, do they? They're not as comfortable. And so what happens to them? Well, sadly, they die. Yeah. And again, I didn't say I didn't say natural selection was nice. I just said it's true. It's a true principle. Now, the dogs then that go on and reproduce are the ones that have the long fur, right? The ones that have the shorter and medium-length fur don't reproduce because they're dead, and dead things don't reproduce so well. So the ones that have the longer fur then find other dogs that have survived because they have the longer fur. And what kind of pups are they going to have? Ones with longer fur, yeah. Because that's the only combination that's available now. You see, the S gene has been eliminated, hasn't it? And so you're never going to get any more medium or short-haired dogs. That's gone. Now, this is a great example of natural selection, okay? Because we see that the environment got cold and the dog. It's a great example of adaptation because the environment got cold and the dogs that survived had the longer fur. This is one type of adaptation. There's another type as well, but we won't get into that today. In any case, we haven't gained any new instructions. In fact, we've lost some instructions. We've lost the information to produce short and medium fur. If the weather goes back to hot, are the dogs going to go back to having short fur? The answer is no. They're just going to die because they don't have that information, you see. Unless some other dogs came in from another part of the world and reintroduced that information, in which case it wasn't really lost. But you see my point here. This is the opposite of evolution because it's in the wrong direction. Evolution is about increasing information in DNA. Natural selection decreases information in the DNA. They are exact opposites. Now, if we started the experiment over again, and we got all three varieties, and this time, let's suppose the environment gets very hot. Well, in that case, the dogs that have the longer fur, well, they don't do so well in a hot environment, do they? Now, they tend to die of exhaustion, so they die. The dogs that do well in the hot environment are the ones that have the shorter fur genes, right? And so they go on and reproduce, and you end up with dogs that have the shorter fur genes. That's what we'd expect, and that's what we observe in nature. We find that animals are well-suited to their environment. If they weren't, they would die, and they wouldn't be there, and you wouldn't find them. It makes sense. And so but again, there's no evolution here. Started with dogs, ended up with dogs. That's just dogs. And we haven't gained any new information. We've actually lost a little bit, haven't we? We've lost we've lost the information for the longer fur and by combination medium fur. That's gone. We've lost information. Natural selection is in the opposite direction of evolution in terms of information content. And this explains why we find dogs that have the longer fur and the colder environments. If they didn't have that longer fur, they would be dead. The dogs that have the shorter fur and are in the hotter environments, if they didn't, they would die. And this is how we explain the different varieties of wild dogs in the world. It makes a lot of sense. So you don't need two of each variety of dog. You don't need two dachshunds and two Dalmatians, and you certainly don't need two poodles on Noah's Ark, right? You just need two dogs. And as they spread out from the mountains of Ararat, where the Ark landed, they carry certain traits with them. And some of those traits are sort of neutral in terms of the environment. But those traits that are a disadvantage in an environment, they tend to be eliminated. And so we expect that animals tend to be well-suited to their environment. It's based on the information that God programmed in to the original kinds, and then natural selection kicking in, and we see that if the environment's not suitable to those traits, the organism dies. Now, my secular colleagues would say, but Dr. Lyle, it's not just natural selection. It's natural selection and mutations that drive evolution. So we need to talk about mutations a little bit. A mutation is basically a mistake in your DNA. It's often a copying mistake. You can think of it as a typo in your DNA. And so here it is with dogs, for example. Dogs are supposed to have information for 4 normal legs. All dogs should have that information. It's not one of the variable traits. They all should have that. But there's a mutation, a copying mistake occurred at some point, and that information was lost. And so some dogs, their legs don't form properly. They tend to have very short legs due to a mutation or combination of mutations, mistakes that have removed some instructions necessary to produce the longer leg. And so you end up with a dog with short, stubby little legs. Now, again, I hope you can see already, this is not evolution, because a mutation, you're losing information, aren't you? You're removing some instructions, and it causes some deformity on the dogs. And so, of course, some mutations are just hideous. Some of them will kill you. I mean, there's certain mutations that if it lands on a certain gene, you're dead. That's it. Your heart doesn't form properly. You're dead. There's some that are just inconvenient. Okay, I have lower back pain, probably due to a mutation. It's just inconvenient, but I can live with it. It's okay. A dog like that, though, if you think about it, a dog in the wild that has short, stubby little legs, he's not going to do so well, right? Because he can't run very fast on those little legs, and he can't catch anything. He's more likely to be picked off by something himself, right? So we find that in nature, mutations tend to be weeded out a little bit. Again, those that are just mildly inconvenient, you might survive. But some of the more severe mutations, the dogs can't survive in the wild. However, some people like dogs that have short, stubby little legs because they can't jump up on you as much, right? And so people will find dogs like these and take care of them. And so the dog doesn't have to survive in the wild. He has a human caretaker to take care of all of his needs, to feed him and so on. So we tend to find that, especially in purebred dogs, they're full of mutations. And a lot of them could never survive on their own. But again, they have a human caretaker who will feed them everything and spend millions of dollars trying to keep them alive because they've got these little problems that have accumulated in their genome. And there are all kinds of mutations in purebred dogs because that's where you tend to concentrate those mutations. There is a mutation that causes a dog's snout not to form properly. A dog's supposed to have a long snout, but there's a mutation that causes the snout to be short, so the dog ends up with an underbite, which can't be comfortable. And the skin was designed to fit the longer snout, so it hangs off the side if you don't clean it and get infected and stuff. And some people think that's cute, but you think if the dog thinks it's cute, that's wonderful, you know? maybe not so much. Poodles have some problems. And by the way, I'm not anti-poodle, but they really do have some problems because they've got mutations that have accumulated in their genome. And they have some diseases that result from that. Some of them are directly a result of mutation. Others are secondary. One example: most dogs have a gene that regulates their fur growth. It grows so long and then it falls out, and that regulates the length of fur. With a poodle, their hair grows forever. That gene has been damaged, and so they can't regulate their hair growth. It just continues to grow indefinitely. Now, that dog could not possibly survive in the wild. Right, because very, you know, in a short period of time, you're gonna have a big poof ball, and he's trying to drag all that hair behind him. There's no way he could survive. But some people like poodles, and so they will shave them and all kinds of interesting shapes. And again, the poodle doesn't have to fend for himself in the wild; he has a human caretaker. And so we see in domestic breeds of dogs lots of examples of mutations. Even the hair can cause secondary issues. The hair can get in their eyes, and their eyes can get infected, and they go blind. And get their ears can get infected, and it can even kill them in some instances. And so a friend of mine says you have to spend millions of dollars keeping these poor things alive because they're missing some instructions. Now, is this evolution? Well, of course not. I mean, we started out with dogs. We ended up with a dog, sort of. But it's kind of the bottom of the line dog, but it's still a dog, right? But it's missing some instructions, you see. It's missing some information. And that's the opposite of evolution, isn't it? Evolution's, again, about what? Increasing information. Mutations remove it very rapidly. They destroy information, which is why these little animals have some problems. And we all have mutations in our genome, by the way, all of us. And so we all have little problems here or there, and that's one of the reasons why. We live in a world that's no longer perfect. God removed his perfect sustaining power at the time of the fall. He still upholds the universe, but he doesn't uphold it perfectly like he once did. And so mutations can accumulate in our genome. And this is how we account for the different breeds of domestic dogs. It's just the information God put in their genome and mutations, mistakes that have crept in, removed a little bit of that information. And so most domestic breeds of dog have some problems because of those mutations. But again, it's in the opposite direction of evolution. We start out with the more wild kinds of dogs. And by the way, we think the dogs that would have got off Noah's Ark would have been kind of like modern wolves. Not exactly the same, but they would have been more like that than anything else. Because with wolves, you still have a lot of the heterozygous genome. In any case, and as you concentrate those mutations, you lose more and more information. But this is not evolution. Evolution is an uphill process, right? Where you're supposedly gaining new information to turn bacteria into horses. This is the opposite. You're turning a dog into a bottom-of-the-line dog, okay? It's still a dog. It's just, you just can't go any lower, really, once you get down to that level, because you're kind of got the minimum level of instructions there. When I'm explaining this to children, I say the information in your DNA is kind of like jelly beans, and you can think of the wild kinds of dogs. They got lots of information available, but then through selectively breeding them, you get down to the poodle, and you don't have a lot of information left at that point. That's pretty much it. And you remove much more, and he's not there anymore. Now, my point is, could you ever turn a dog into a cat by removing jelly beans? And the answer is no, right? Removing information, because cats have different information in their DNA. Again, some of it's the same because we use the same proteins. But you can't get different information by removing information. That's all mutations do. That's all natural selection does. The two processes that supposedly drive evolution are in the opposite direction of evolution. Isn't that ironic? Evolution is about an increase in information. Natural selection and mutations both decrease information in the genome. And this is good science, right? We're looking, we're observing, we're testing and repeating in the present. When we look at dogs, we find they reproduce dogs. How about that? That's what we'd expect in the creation worldview. They beget others like themselves, different varieties to be sure, but they're still dogs. This is good observational science. We can test it and repeat it in the present, and it confirms what we would expect given biblical creation. God really did create animals according to their kinds. By the way, mutations can be beneficial, but that's irrelevant. People like to talk about mutations that help an organism survive. That can happen. Here it is, for example, with H. pylori. This is a bacteria that gives you stomach ulcers, and you can kill that bacterium by taking an antibiotic. The antibiotic is absorbed into the bacterium. He's got an enzyme that's part of his system that he produces, it's part of his chemistry, that when it interacts with that antibiotic, it converts it into a poison. The poison kills the bacterium, and you feel better. There's a mutated form of H. pylori that lacks the ability to produce the enzyme that would have broken down the antibiotic into a poison. And so you take your antibiotic, and he survives. But he survives because he's missing some instructions. You see my point? And so the normal bacteria then are killed off by the antibiotic, and then you have, sometimes they call them superbugs, right? You get these in hospitals because you have lots of antibiotics in hospitals. The only bacteria that survive are the ones that have the mutated gene. But are they really superbugs? No. They're missing some instructions. They can survive without those instructions, apparently. And in that particular environment, it benefits them. But it's still in the opposite direction of evolution because you're removing information from the genome. You're not going to get anything other than a bacteria from that. You're just going to get a lower level bacteria. You're going to eventually end up with the poodle of the bacteria world. Okay? Dr. Lise Bettner, PhD in biophysics, he says, not even one mutation has been observed that adds a little information to the genome. And if evolution were true, there ought to be millions of them. Millions. So you see, when we study genetics, using good observational science, we find it confirms creation. Animals reproduce animals according to their kind. They can lose information, but they don't gain brand new instructions as evolution requires. We've been talking about information. What is information? Ever thought about that? We sort of know what it is. I mean, you pick up a book and you read it, and it's got information in it, right? It's got words, and these words mean things, and so on. Well, we can define information according to these three criteria. First of all, information always involves a symbolic code system. And so when I pick up a book, and I see the word camels here. I happen to open up to Isaiah 60, verse 6. A multitude of camels. Now, I don't see camels here. I see the word camels, which represents the animal. That's a symbolic code system. That's always the case with words. Words symbolize what they represent. And so there's a symbolic code system there. That's true in all books that you would read. There's a language convention. This Bible happens to be English, originally written in Hebrew and Greek, of course. You can translate it into other language, but there is a convention there with rules of syntax and grammar. And there's meaning. I could learn something when I read this book. I could learn something. If you have a cookbook, the meaning there is that you're supposed to bake the cake and you're supposed to feed yourself, right, or others. So there's an expected action on the person who wrote the information expects that the reader will act in a particular way. He will act on that information, either just by learning something new or by going out and baking a cake if it's a cookbook or whatever. When you have these three things, you have information. And when you have information, there are certain rules that apply to that. Now, let's apply, first of all, let's see if we have some information here. Could this be information? Could be. It looks like there might be a code system there, right? Might be a language convention. It looks organized. It looks like there might be a language there. There might be meaning. Hard to tell. Well, in fact, this is information. And I know that because I know the code system. And I can translate it for you. This is actually Genesis 1, 1 through 5 in the form of icons. You see, in the beginning, you see the clipboard, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and so on. And that's Genesis chapter 1 in the form of icons. Now, that is information. Now, when you have information, certain laws apply. Just like when you have energy, you have laws of nature that apply to energy, like the law of conservation of energy, which says you can't create or destroy energy, you can only transform it. Well, there are laws of information as well. And one of those is that information never generates by itself in matter. Dr. Werner Gett, who's one of the world's experts on information theory, says there's no known law of nature, no known process, and no known sequence of events which can cause information to originate by itself in matter. So where does information come from then? If information doesn't just spontaneously generate in matter, where does information come from? And you know the answer to that. It comes from a mind. When you read a book, it's got information in it. Where did that book get the information from? Probably from a machine that makes lots of books simultaneously, right? Where did that machine get its information? Probably from a computer. Where did it get its information? From another computer. It's been copied many times. Unintelligent machines can copy information. A Xerox machine can copy information. But only a mind can create information. And that, in fact, is a law of nature. When its progress along the chain of transmission events is traced backwards, every piece of information leads to a mental source, the mind of the sender. Information always comes from a mind. That's a law of nature, and we'd expect that. It wouldn't even occur to you to pick up a book and say, boy, I think this was produced by an explosion in a typewriter, right? If it's got information in it, you know that somebody originally wrote that information. It might have been copied by unintelligent things like a Xerox machine, but a Xerox machine can't create new information. A Xerox machine might lose information if it's malfunctioning and a paragraph gets lost. That can happen. You might even have a Xerox machine that accidentally duplicates a page, but do you have any new information? No. You just got the same information twice. You haven't gained any new information. That's what we'd expect on the laws of information theory. Now, that's very interesting, because what do we have in DNA? Information. All the information to make you. Could that information have possibly come about by a gradual evolutionary process, a mindless process? The answer is no, because the laws of information science do not allow for that. According to the laws of information science, only a mind can create information. Where did you get the information in your DNA? You got it from your parents, they got it from their parents, they got it from their parents, all the way back to Adam and Eve, who got it from God, the mind of God. You see, the laws of information theory are consistent with what the Bible teaches and wildly inconsistent with evolution. Science really does confirm the Bible. It doesn't confirm evolution. It defies evolution. We don't observe brand new information being generated in matter. And yet that's exactly what evolutionists would have us believe about DNA. And by the way, in their heart of hearts, evolutionists really do know that information always comes from the mind. They really do. And I can prove this because I did a social experiment a few years ago. I posted an article on my blog. My blog's just my name, jasonlyle.com. I don't update it very often, but anyway. I posted this article on the origin of articles by means of natural selection. And this article is supposed to persuade you that articles have no authors. How do articles get generated? Well, they're basically a collection of typos. And granted, most typos make an article worse. But occasionally you might expect a typo would make an article better, And so the ones that make the article worse, those get thrown away. And only the ones that make it better and improve the article get copied. And so eventually, over millions of years, articles get better and longer and more impressive. Some of them evolve all the way into books, right? We know this happens, right? Because that's, you know, how else would you account for the origin of articles? You're not going to believe somebody wrote them, right? Are you one of those authorists that believes that articles have authors? No, that's crazy. The funny thing was not so much the article. The funny thing was the responses I got to it. I allow evolutionists to post on my blog, and a lot of the evolutionists chimed in and said, "We know you wrote this, Dr. Lyle." And I said, "How? Did you see me write it?" Well, no, but we could check IP addresses. Well, did you do that? Well, no, but we could. In any case, I admit to posting it. When this thing evolved on my computer, I couldn't help but post it. It was too good, right? I admit that. But how do you know I wrote it? Well, you know, it says, it's got your name on it. You believe everything you read? Bible says it was written by God. You believe that? I smell some inconsistency. It was funny. They couldn't prove that I wrote it. And I kept pushing them to, you know, can you provide any evidence that this article has an author? Or is it just blind faith on your part? Now, of course, they did have a good reason, but they couldn't say it. Their good reason is because this article has information in it, and information always comes from a mind. But the moment they admit that, you can't have evolution, because the information in your DNA has to come from a mind and not by evolution. You see that? I had them on the horns of a dilemma. They couldn't refute me without simultaneously refuting themselves. That's a very powerful way of arguing, by the way, a very powerful way of debating. And it was just a lot of fun. I just kept chiding him politely. I kept chiding him, you know, hey, if you want to believe in authors, that's fine. Keep it in church, you know, don't post it here. And a lot of fun. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the people listening for alien radio signals from space, because they think we're going to find intelligent life out in space. I don't believe that, but that's what they think. In any case, there are a lot of radio signals in space. Did you know stars give off radio signals? It sounds like static, but they do. They produce radio. So does the sun. I've heard it. It sounds like static. How would you distinguish an intelligent signal from all of these natural signals in the universe? Well, the answer the SETI folks will tell you is that the intelligent signal will have information in it, right? It's going to have information. It's going to have instructions, maybe instructions on how to build a warp drive or something, and then we build it and it works, and we say, wow, there must be intelligent life out there, because there's no way that that information could be generated by chance. But then you look at DNA, well, that information was generated by chance. You see, it doesn't work, does it? They're inconsistent. They know in their heart of hearts that information always comes from a mind, but they can't admit that when it comes to DNA, because then they'd have to admit there's God. They'd have to admit that the biblical worldview is true. What about geology? Study of rocks, fossils, that kind of thing. Paleontology would be fossils. I was always taught that rocks are millions of years old, hundreds of millions even, and that this is proved by radiometric dating. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of details on this, but I will give you just some, because I think it's good for us to know this. The way radiometric dating works, I mean, people have these misconceptions of it, right? They think, well, it's just, you know, scientists, they take the rock, they scan it with their tricorder, and it just gives you the age, right? You know, it measures the ageicles in it. Well, that's not how it works. The way it works is there are certain kinds of atoms. We're all made of atoms, but most atoms are stable, which means they will remain the same atom that they always were since creation. But some atoms are unstable, like uranium. Uranium-238 is an unstable atom. And what that means is it will spontaneously change into another atom. You don't have to do anything to it. It does it on its own. It will change into thorium. And thorium is also unstable, so it will change into this, which changes into this, all the way down to lead-206. Lead-206 is stable. So once you're lead-206, you're always lead-206. And this happens atom by atom. They just kind of pop off. Like, you can think of like popcorn, right? One atom changing into another. And it happens statistically at a very predictable rate. And for uranium, it's very slow. It would take a long time for uranium to turn into lead, but eventually it will. So the bottom line is, if you had a chunk of 100% uranium and you waited for a long time, eventually it would be uranium and lead with some of the intermediate elements as well. If you waited long enough, eventually it would be all lead. Okay? Uranium turns into lead. That's pretty easy. And the idea is, well, if you find a rock that's got some uranium and some lead in it, you could use that to find out how old the rock is, because we know the rate at which it changes. That's pretty clever, isn't it? That's a neat idea. But there's a problem. How do you know the rock was all uranium when it started? And by the way, secularists do not assume that the rock was all uranium when it started. They assume that it had some lead in there to begin with. But how much lead should we start with? Well, you tell me how old you want the rock to be, I'll tell you how much lead it started with. You see the problem? You can't really know what it started with. You weren't there. You don't know how it started. The idea is uranium turning into lead is like sand going from the upper chamber to the bottom chamber in an hourglass. And you can use an hourglass to tell time. You can if you make certain assumptions. If when you came in here this morning, you saw an hourglass and it looked like that, and I say, how long ago did I turn that over? You say, well, it's easy. It's an hourglass. It's halfway through, about half an hour. I say, I gotcha. Because in fact, when I came in here, I turned it over 1 minute ago, but already a lot of the sand was in the bottom chamber, you see. You have to make assumptions about the past to use any kind of time indicator like that if you're going to make a scientific assessment of age. How do you know that somebody didn't add sand when you're not looking? That's another problem. Uranium's leachable in salt water. It can move in and out of the rocks. So it could be added. New uranium could be added. Lead can be removed and so on. How do you know the throat of the bottle's always been the same size? That's probably a pretty safe assumption for an hourglass. But with radioactive decay, there are certain mechanisms that will speed it up. In a laboratory, we've been able to speed up certain kinds of radioactive decay by a factor of a billion. Okay, so it's not the constant thing that I was taught in school. Well, anyway, bottom line, we've taken rocks that were produced in the Mount St. Helens volcanic eruption, brand new rocks, and when they harden that's supposed to set the zero point of the clock. We sent them in and had them radiometrically dated. Now, normally you wouldn't do that on a rock that you already know the age, because it's expensive to do it. But we wanted to test the method, because we know what the answer is. We know the rock's brand new. It's a few years old. It was about 10 years old when we did this. And they sent them in, and the estimated ages came back at hundreds of thousands to millions of years on these rocks that we know are only 10 years old. Isn't that interesting? You say, well, that's an isolated incident. It's not. We've done it also with rocks in Hawaii. You go to Hawaii and you date the rocks there, you will get millions of years. I keep telling my boss, I need to do this experiment myself. He needs to send me to Hawaii to collect some samples. So purely for science, of course. But it is true. You will get millions of years on rocks that are brand new, that just came out of the volcano. Radiometric dating has been shown to not work on rocks of known age. Secularists assume it works on rocks of unknown age. Is that logical? If I gave you a calculator, Merry Christmas, here's your calculator, and you put 2 plus 2 equals, and it gave you 57,212. Would you say, yeah, this is great. Well, don't worry, it works on big numbers. I don't think that's a good argument, do you? If I can't trust it on small matters, how can I trust it on large matters? That's a biblical principle, actually. You know, there are the interesting thing is, radiometric dating is, you'd say, well, if it's got all these problems, why do secularists use it? Because it's just about the only one that gives them the numbers that they like. That's what it comes down to. There are hundreds of Earth processes that demonstrate that the Earth is much younger than billions of years. Hundreds of them. Let me give you just a couple of examples real quick. The rate at which salt flows into the ocean. Even fresh rivers have a little bit of salt in them. They pick it up from the continents and they dump it in the ocean at 450 million tons per year. The water evaporates, but it leaves the salt. So the oceans are actually getting a little saltier every year. And you do the math and you run it backwards, you find that oceans can't be more than a maximum of 62 million years old because they would have no salt in them before that. You can't have less salt than no salt, right? So that's an upper limit. Of course, the true age would be much less than that because the ocean started salty. But that's an upper limit, and that's perfectly consistent with the true age of 6,000 years, but wildly inconsistent with the secular age of 3 billion years for oceans. They can't be that old. Or the rate at which mud accumulates on the ocean floor. You measure the amount of mud that's there, you measure the rate at which it's deposited, you get a maximum age of 12 million years. It's nowhere near the 3 billion years that they need it to be. Or dendrochronology, measuring tree rings. You don't get anywhere near millions of years when you do that. Or human population. How long does it take to get Earth's current population from two people? Nowhere near millions of years. It's a few thousand years. Well, we have the birth certificate of the universe. This is the best evidence, right, that the world's young. It's because God told us how he did it, at least in terms of a basic overview, and when. He tells us he created in 6 days, and he tells us the ages of the patriarchs and so on. You can add those up, and you get a few thousand years between between Adam and Christ's earthly ministry, and a couple thousand years after that is today. And so you have an age of about 6,000 years. And the science confirms that. So you see, you don't have to be intimidated by the secularists to say, well, we know the world's billions of years old. No, you don't. You've got one method that you use that has been demonstrated to not work on rocks of known age, and that's the one you pin your hopes on because it gives you the answer that you want. That's not logical. Not logical at all. What it comes down to is this. The secular scientists say the Earth's billions of years old. Take my word for it. God says, I created in 6 days. Take my word for it. That's really the issue. That's really what it comes down to. What about fossils? I was always given the impression that fossils take a long time to form, but we find fossils all over the world. We find marine fossils, fish, things like that, on continents. That's interesting. How do you account for that in a secular view? See, I can make sense of that. I know there was a worldwide flood. Of course, that's going to bury fish on top of the continents. I'd expect that. And that's what we find. But my secularists say, or at least I had the impression in school, at least, that fossils take a long time to form. Here's a fossil ichthyosaur, buried, and fossilized in the process of giving birth. There's the baby ichthyosaur being born. They're born tail first because they're air breathers. And so as soon as he's born, he has to swim to the surface, get his first breath of air. Kind of amazing. Here's a fish fossilized in the process of eating another fish. That seemed to happen pretty fast, right? Talk about fast food. Wow. Most things don't fossilize. When you die, you're probably not going to become a fossil. Hate to spoil your dreams, but you're probably not going to be a fossil. And to illustrate this, I've been picking on dogs. We'll pick on cats now. We're going to do an experiment on our dead cat, Earl. Okay? So we're going to watch him slowly fossilize over millions of years. So we'll dead cat on grass. Well, what happens? Day 3, smelly dead cat on grass. Okay, that's to be expected. Day 9, very smelly dead cat on grass. Day 20, parts of Earl missing. Day 38, more of Earl missing. Day 65, Earl's missing. And you know that, right? You know that animals don't just turn into statues, fossils over millions of years. They decay. They're recycled back into the environment. They're picked off by scavengers. You see, anything that's open and exposed to the environment like that is not going to fossilize. To fossilize something, you need to bury it. And even then, I was given the wrong impression. I was told, well, the fish dies, sinks down to the bottom, and these rock layers are mud that accumulated over millions of years. But the problem is, if this layer happened millions of years after that one, the top of the fish would have decayed, right? You got to bury it fast if you're going to fossilize it. And fish, that doesn't happen today. Fossilization doesn't really happen today, at least not on the scale that we see it in the fossil record. Fish normally die, they normally float, and they are picked off by scavengers. Maybe you've seen one of those documentaries where they show you the ocean floor. I love those things, and it's busy. I've seen a time-lapse one. What you don't see is billions of dead fish waiting to fossilize. You don't see that. They're recycled back into the environment. Now, if you really want to form a fossil fish, here's how you do it. You go home to your aquarium, and you dump some concrete on your fish, okay? This is still legal in Texas, probably not in California, but anyway. That's going to bury the fish. It's going to kill them, of course. It's going to bury them. And generally, there's enough bacteria left that they can dissolve away the outer portions of the fish, the soft parts, but there's not enough that they can dissolve away the bone. And so the bone permineralizes. Minerals come in and fill in all the holes in the bone. Bone is porous. It's light. Fossils are heavy because the minerals have come and filled in all the holes in the bone, and you end up with a stone that looks like the bones of your original organism. Fossil fish. That's how you do it. And it doesn't take millions of years. We can do it in a laboratory. It just doesn't take that long. It has to happen fast or it's not going to happen at all. There are some places where it happens so fast, even the soft tissue is fossilized. I've seen fossils of jellyfish. They have no bones, of course, but the structure's preserved. That can happen, but it has to happen fast. What about the kinds of fossils we find? Well, I was taught, I had a textbook. I remember going through high school. I had a textbook that showed the evolution of the horse. There you go, evolution in action. And of course, it's only speculation that this one is descended from that one. We don't know that. They could have lived at the same time, potentially. That's certainly possible. You say, but yeah, this one's big and that one's small. Well, so there are horses of different sizes today. They're just different breeds. Those are both adult horses. They're just different breeds, you see. There are all kinds of variety in the horse kind. And some of those varieties have gone extinct, where the toe was a little different and so on. That's not evolution. That's variation within a kind. That's exactly what we'd expect given biblical creation, isn't it? You see, you don't find a continuum of one kind changing into another. Oh, sure, there are a handful of disputed specimens, but the general rule is you find variation within a kind, exactly what you'd expect to find if creation were true and if there was a worldwide flood. And that's what we find. What about the rocks in which these fossils are found? Don't rocks take millions of years to form? Here's a set of car keys embedded inside solid rock. I don't think that took millions of years to form. Here's a man-made clock embedded inside solid rock. I don't think that took millions of years to form. Unless clocks are older than I think they are, right? Well, surely these layers took millions of years to form. There's a person down there for scale. Look at all those layers. Those didn't exist before 1980. Those were produced in the Mount St. Helens volcanic eruptions. It had a pyroclastic flow that came and formed all these new sedimentary rock layers. Isn't that interesting? One volcano, and a rather small volcano by volcanic standards. And then it cut through, a later eruption cut through those layers and produced a canyon 1/40th the scale of the Grand Canyon in a matter of hours. It doesn't take millions of years. Mount St. Helens demonstrated that a lot of the things that secularists teach take millions of years, in fact, can happen very quickly under catastrophic conditions, the kinds of conditions that would have existed during the flood year. The Bible says that on the flood year, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and that would be, we think it's probably underwater volcanoes, all of them going off. That's going to do amazing damage, and it's going to produce the kinds of features that we see in the world today. So you see, geology confirms, when we examine it scientifically, it confirms creation and a worldwide flood. It's what we'd expect given what the Bible teaches. It does not confirm millions of years of slow, gradual processes. You would not get fossils if that happened. The fact that you find fossils all over the earth, land animals mixed with fish even, we've got a fossil at ICR. It's got a dinosaur and a fish. Now, where did that happen? Because one lives in the ocean, one lives on the... You see, it has to be a flood that does that kind of thing. That's very common, very common. So you see, these rock layers remind us that God judges sin. They are evidence of a worldwide flood. They're not evidence of evolution. They're evidence that God judges sin. The rock layers really are telling us, repent. God is a righteous judge. We wouldn't respect him if he weren't. If he were a wicked judge and just let sin go unpunished, he would be corrupt. God is a righteous judge, and he has to judge sin. But he's a merciful judge as well, and he's willing to pay that penalty himself. You see, just during the flood year, God provided a way of escape. He told Noah that flood was coming, and he told them how to build an ark to prepare for it. And the Bible says Noah was a preacher of righteousness. I'm sure he was preaching, come on board the ark and be saved. And only 8 people responded to that message, right? Noah and his immediate family and his son's wives. I think it's interesting, too, the Bible says that God was the one that closed the door on the ark. I think that's significant. God is the one that determines when time of mercy is over, time of judgment is to begin. And he did that before with water. He's going to do it again by fire. Are you ready? That's the real question. Well, we have a lot of resources that I'd encourage you to get out by the book table. Let me just run over some of these real quick for you. If you'd like to learn more about what we talked about today, the book to get, Creation Basics and Beyond. This is written by all of our staff scientists at ICR. We try to keep the cookies at the bottom level, so it's easy to understand. It is Creation Basics, but it goes into a little more depth as well. If you want that information, it's there. It's going to answer all your questions like, was there an ice age? And what about distant starlight? How did God get the light from the earth in 6,000 years? And what about continental drift or plate tectonics? And where did the water for the flood come from and where did it go? And how did Noah get all the animals on the ark anyway? All answered in that book. And those are the questions that critics ask. And you study just a little bit of the basics of science. You don't have to have a PhD in science or a master's degree or bachelor's degree. You just study the basics, and you can answer 90% of people's questions about Genesis. And that's powerful. I've seen people that have eventually gotten saved because of that process, ultimately because the Holy Spirit saves them. But he uses this kind of information to open their eyes. It's powerful stuff. If you say, I don't know, that looks awfully thick and intimidating, we have a student version as well. You can get the thinner student version. It has more pictures in it, so there you go. Taking Back Astronomy, this is my apologetic book on astronomy. I want to show how the universe declares God's glory, not a big bang in billions of years. Very powerful resource, actually. Lots of evidence for a young solar system. It can't be billions of years old. And it's got a lot of beautiful pictures in it. It's illustrated, fully illustrated. Some people have thought it's a children's book because it has all those pictures. My theory is adults like pictures, too. So there you go. Ultimate Proof of Creation. I didn't really prove creation this morning. I just showed you that it makes sense in light of what the Bible teaches. If you want a proof, if you want to demonstrate that creation really is true, I believe that's possible, and this book will show you how to do that. I've used this proof on secularists. I've never had anyone be able to refute it. No one's been able to come back from it. I've been using it for years. You know how Jesus in his earthly ministry, the Pharisees and Sadducees would come and they try to trick him, and he just turned it around on them? You can learn to do that. You don't have to have a PhD. It's basic stuff. It's a new way of thinking, but once you get it, it's powerful. I've been able to teach this to teenagers in 1 week. It's not that difficult. It's more than I can do in one sermon, but it's powerful stuff. Understanding Genesis. What about Christians who say, yeah, but the days weren't really days. They were perhaps long periods of time or something like that. That's going to show you that God really does mean what he says in Genesis, and you can demonstrate that conclusively. Discerning truth, how to spot errors in reasoning. Logic is something they don't teach in most public schools anymore, right? And I think that's because it was necessary for them to remove logic if they're going to teach evolution, frankly. I'm just going to say it. Because evolution is not logical. And that's going to show you how to spot logical fallacies. It's a short book. You can read it in an afternoon. And it's got two tests in the back where you can test your logical fallacy detection skills with an answer key so you can see how you did. We got DVDs. You say, I don't have time to read. We got DVDs. I feel your pain. So read the TV. It's a lot easier. Your Origins Matter. This is the presentation I did when I was here last year. We have it on DVD. Now, it's not out there, but you can back order it. And please do. This is a fantastic resource showing you why Genesis really does matter. What about Christians who say, well, it doesn't matter what you believe. Just trust in Jesus. This is the DVD you'll want to share with them. Created Cosmos takes you on a tour through the universe. It's the planetarium show I wrote for the Creation Museum. The Secret Code of Creation shows you that God has built beauty in an aspect of creation that most people have never even thought about, and there is no secular explanation for it. This is mind-blowing. Secret Code of Creation. I don't want to give any more away because it's just cool. It wouldn't be a secret if I gave it away, right? But you can learn that secret, and it's very powerful. Stargazer's Guide to the Night Sky, how to better enjoy the night sky from a Christian perspective. And it's got beautiful full-color star charts and so on, tell you how to find things like Saturn. You can see Saturn's rings in binoculars. You just got to know which one's Saturn. That's where the book will help you. Acts and Facts. How many of you are already getting Acts and Facts, our free monthly magazine? Okay. Very few righteous in this service. Okay. the rest of you need to repent of that sin and sign up in the lobby out front. This is it's a free magazine, so why not? I mean, it's going to bless you. We got all kinds of wonderful articles that are faith-affirming. I think you'll really enjoy it, and you can share it with your secular friends, and they'll hopefully enjoy it as well, and it'll challenge them. If they're not Christians, it'll challenge them. So it really is free. Not too many things free in this world, right? Just salvation and Acts and Facts. And check us out on the web as well, icr.org. And if you want to see how articles evolve over millions of years, check out my blog as well. A lot of fun there. So thank you so much for having me out to speak. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Go ahead. Let's go ahead and stand.